Okay, 10 December.
All right, shall we?
Yes.
Can we just go?
Go.
Okay, you going to start off? Grab your chairs. By the way, thanks to Barry Morrison and Gray Bar again for, as always, coming up with a nice place for us to hold the meeting. And we always appreciate that. Thank you. So, tonight we have Scott Graneman. Scott's a former VP of this group, and he's a principal at...
I've got all that taken care of, Gary.
Yeah, you can get all that. So with that, I will turn it over to Scott Graneman.
All right. Thank you. Hello, everybody. Good to see you guys again. It's a nice night, relatively speaking. Great room here. I feel like I should be telling you you're all fired, or our stock just lost 3/4 of its value, the way this room's organized. Right, exactly. Announce the bailout. So before we get started, I wanted to talk about my new project, which is not my book. Some of you guys know about this. His name's Finn, and he was born... thank you. He was born on the 5th. Pretty exciting for me, 8 pounds, 7 ounces. Yeah, he's big, full head of hair already. His name is Finn Scott Graneman Yeager, 21 inches long. What amazed me is it only took 2 hours from the mother breaking water to his birth. It actually only took 20 minutes once we got to the hospital. So I'm glad we got to the hospital when we did then, because in the car.
Quick download.
Yeah, exactly, very quick download. He already looks like a little old man. I think he looks Jewish in that picture, actually. So this is the mom and his little brother and me. That's my ex-wife, Denise. She met him. Robin, who's in the back, is going to be the step-Robin. Robin's hanging out with him there. Somebody finally took a picture of me with him. Of course, that took like 3 days. That's something I'm learning right now, the father. He's taking the pictures. He's not in the pictures. Now, there was a question about paternity initially. Some people were not sure that he was mine. But once he was, in fact, born, I don't think there's any doubt. In fact, he is my kid. So I think the similarities are eerily present. So anyway, before we got started with the book, and because he is mentioned in the book, I did want to bring him up as well. He's a great little guy. And I'm very proud of it. So, and I'll be bringing him here as soon as he gets old enough to bring. So, I will try to make sure his first word is Unix, or something along those lines.
Start him off on the command line, huh?
Right, yeah. He's doing command line on the play. So, they asked me to come speak about my new book, which is out on the 14th. I got a copy early, so I'm going to pass this around. It is 600 pages. I was telling Stan, my editor called me about near the end of the whole project.
Hold it, grab him!
Pass copy.
I should not have given it to you first. He's going to tell a lot. Will you call every library for me? Tell them to get a copy of
that? Start on the editor room.
So they, my editor called me and said, Scott, there's a problem. You were supposed to write 400 pages. And I said, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'll figure out something else to write about. And she said, no. The problem is you turned in 600 pages. So it's a 600-page book. It's got tons of stuff on there. I will be honest with you about a couple things. Number one, there's already stuff outdated in there already because this is a fast-moving train with Google. But I have a blog that I'm going to give you guys the address where I'm trying to keep stuff up to date. Put errata on there if I find errors and things like that. So some of you guys don't know me. I do teach at WashU a variety of technical courses in all different areas. I've also taught at Webster and community colleges in the area. My first book was on Firefox. My second book was Hacking Nopix. Robert Sitek was the tech editor on that and wrote an appendix on that book. My third book is Linux Phrasebook, which is now sold close to 16,000 copies. So I consider that a nerd bestseller. So that's great. I'm really proud of that one. I still use that one myself all the time. Ubuntu Hacks I contributed to. I also contributed to Microsoft Vista. I wrote the two appendices at the end about how the EULA in Vista was even worse than the EULA in XP, and about how the Europeans and Asians were suing Microsoft for antitrust violations. So when they asked me to write this, I said, so I get to write two chapters critical of Microsoft. I don't actually have to buy Vista to write them, and you're paying me? Whoa. I'll do it. So that's great. I also wrote this book last summer, Podcasting with Audacity. Audacity being the audio editing program that I'm sure a lot of you guys have used. Even if you're not podcasting, there's still a ton of great info in there. Dominic is the kid, I say kid because he's 25, that actually invented Audacity. And so we wrote that. And then this book, Google Apps Deciphered, which is part of a new series called the Negus Software Solutions Series. And all in some way related to open source in different ways. So I'm real proud of this. It should be out on the 14th. It's already available on Amazon, pre-orders and all that sort of thing. I also do some stuff for Security Focus and Linux Magazine, which is no longer print. It's now moved online. And finally, I have a company called WebSanity, and we host and develop websites for a variety of customers, including the St. Louis Zoo, Fontbonne, and my favorite, the Dairy Calf and Heifer Association. So, kind of fun. So what is Google Apps? Well, before I start, does anybody in here, I'm not talking about a Gmail account where you have an address at gmail.com. I'm asking, does anybody actually have Google Apps? It used to be called Google Apps for your domain. Has anybody signed up with Google Apps? No? I'm really surprised. Okay. With Google Apps, not
the pack.
No, Google Apps for your domain, it used to be. It's where you've had your domain name at Google. Okay, all of you guys, trust me, this is a great deal. You're going to enjoy this. Yeah.
I did it.
You did it. Okay, I've got one other person. Because I've done like 20 of them now at this point. So I love it. So what is Google Apps? Well, basically, Google has taken a Gmail where it's at your domain. So if you notice in the top there, it says scott@grandeman.com. So it's not scott@gmail. It's my domain name, but all the email is at Google. It's all done through Gmail's interface. That includes a contact manager. That also includes a calendar. So I go to calendar.grandeman.com, and this is my Google Calendar. It also includes Google Docs. I go to docs.grandeman.com, and I'll go into all the details about this. And there are other services, too, which I'll mention in addition to these. And then there's also a management interface. Now, I didn't get the Grandeman when I, throughout the book, I had a dream. I woke up on January 1st of this year, actually, and I turned to Robin and I said, I just had this brilliant idea for a domain name. And she was like, what? And I said, Heavy Metal Massage. And she said, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I said, yeah, but domains are $10, so what the hell? So I registered it. Well, that's the domain I used throughout this entire book, is Heavy Metal Massage. So I'm actually not going into that line of work. But that's why it's there. This is the management interface for Google Apps. And from here, the administrator of the account can set up services, configure services, add users, delete users, change users, and so on. So this is the admin interface you're seeing there. Now, the first thing I want to talk about with Google Apps is the fact, and this is a thing you need to know just to get started, is there are 5 different editions of Google Apps. There's not one Google Apps. There's 5 different types of Google Apps, and you choose which one you want to sign up for. The 5 are Standard, Premier, Team, Education, which weirdly is also what nonprofits use. So if any of you guys work for nonprofits, have family or friends that work at nonprofits, they would sign up for the Education version of Google Apps, even though they're nonprofits. And finally, Partner Edition, that's for ISPs. And to sign up for that, you have to have like 10,000 addresses or accounts that you're going to bring to this. So I doubt if any of you would do that, but those are the 5. Let me talk 1 second about what Team is. This is kind of brilliant on Google's part, although I know some of you guys that are IT admins are going to be kind of peeved about it. Google said, hey, let's say that you're working at a corporation somewhere, and let's say Omnitech grows and grows and grows, and there's 200 employees, and you refuse to let anybody use Google. You're like, no, we have our own mail servers, we have our own wikis and all that stuff, we're not going to let you guys use Google Apps. And these 3 guys who work for Omnitech are like, man, we really would like to use Google Apps. This would be great if we could do the document collaboration and all that stuff. If they sign up for Google Apps Team Edition, all they have to do is all sign up and have the same domain name in their email address. And it is like a little island of Google Apps separated from the main corporation. So you actually don't need to configure DNS. The interesting thing about this is you don't really get email, because your email is already taken care of with your main corporation, but you do get a lot of those other features like Google Docs and Google Calendar and things like that. Does that make sense to you guys? Now, when Lee finds out about this, Google has this thing in place where if you can verify that you're the administrator of that domain name by changing DNS or by putting a file on the website, you can then shut it off. You can shut it off and say, no, no, nobody at omnitech.com gets to use Google Apps. Or you could say, okay, we'll let everybody use Google Apps, fine, we'll sign up for this and make it official. Or you can just keep track of it. So you got three choices. Shut it down, adopt it wholeheartedly, or keep track of it. So I actually thought, I wonder what happens if I sign up at woostle.edu for Google Team Edition. There's like 350 people that are already part of the team, students, faculty, whoever, who have signed up just so they can collaborate. WashU's basically, I don't even think they know about it at all, and so they're just kind of letting it go.
How do you use a domain name in two places? Is that just a separate login at Google?
The domain, you aren't signing up for email, so there's nothing to route.
So, what I'm saying,
so it just becomes a login.
So okay, so basically you log into Google with woostle.edu.
Right, you create a Google account with your omnitech.net email address as the address. And the thing is, if he signs up with omnitech.net and he signs up with omnitech.net, but he signs up with his Yahoo, they're not on the same team at all. You can't do that. Okay. So you all three have to sign up with the same domain name in your email address. Does that make sense?
And that's a separate sign up for Gmail.
Totally. Totally, completely separate from Gmail. Yeah.
Is this a conscious process, or because I have signed up on Google Calendar to Stan at smooth.org.
Uh-huh.
So if Carl signs up,
oh boy,
you know, what happens?
Oh gosh, that is such a nightmare when people do that. Would you ask that question at the very end? I thought about including it. I thought, no, nobody has had that problem, so I won't talk about it. So if you remind me at the very end, I'll talk a minute about it, because this is a pain in the rear, what you just described. But I've got a whole, the third appendix in the book is just about that problem, believe it or not. So those are the five editions. Well, let me compare the five. The standard edition is free. Completely free, you can have hundreds and hundreds of accounts. Perfectly free. So any of you guys that have your own business, or you work in a small or medium-sized business, or your wife is a teacher somewhere at a small school, or you're part of an organization, you could sign up everybody with that domain name, and it'd be perfectly free. Everybody gets Gmail, they get, every single person that signs up gets 6.75 gigs of space for email, which is a ridiculous amount of space, and that goes up every second. So if you actually go to the Gmail page, it actually dings up, you know, and a little bit every single second. You do get ads, but, you know, everybody in here knows it's easy to block ads in Firefox with the ad block extension, so big deal. The Premier Edition costs $50 per user per year. Now, you might be thinking, why in the world would you pay for that when you can get the Standard Edition? Well, three reasons. Number one, you have a 99% uptime guarantee from Google. So you're guaranteed an uptime. You're not with Standard. Now, that said, Google Gmail hardly ever goes down, so it's not like you need to worry, but you do get the uptime guarantee. You also get 25 gigs of storage per user instead of almost 7, and ads are optional. The administrator can turn off ads or not in Gmail, in the web interface. The Team Edition doesn't have Gmail, and it's free. The Education Edition is completely free, again, no matter how many users. Arizona State University switched over like 70,000 accounts, and it's all free. They're not paying a dime at all for this. So again, if any of you guys, I know Catholic schools never have enough money in particular. I know a lot of small private schools never have enough, and you guys probably know people or have your kids going there. Talk to them there. They can switch over. It's nothing. 6.75, and ads are optional there as well. And finally, the Partner Edition, that's for ISPs. It's free if you allow ads to be shown. It's 15 cents per user per month. But again, there's like a 10,000 user minimum. So don't get any ideas. However, Every single one gets Google Calendar. They all get Google Docs. They all get Google Talk, which is Google's IM program. They all get Google Sites except Partner, which is their wiki. They have free. You can create as many wikis as you want. So that's what they call it, sites. They're trying to deprecate the use of the word wikis to make it more user-friendly. Google Start Page, which is like a My Yahoo, but it's Google. That's available to everybody. And if you pay, either as a partner or as Premier, you get 24/7 phone support.
Is the Start Page, is that really iGoogle?
Well, that's iGoogle is the iGoogle is the non-Google Apps version.
Oh, okay.
And it is miles better than Start Page. Start Page Google Apps sucks. In fact, I wrote in the chapter, I excoriated it. It is awful. iGoogle is so much better, and what they need to do is roll those consumer features into Start Page. So Start Page is there. Some people might find it useful. I think it sucks.
Right,
totally.
You could just use iGoogle instead.
Well, except that's not connected to your account, so those are two different accounts. So then that's why you start getting into complications. So that's the different editions. Most of you guys. And by the way, families can do this. Sign up for the standard edition. If you have a domain name for your family, you know, go sign up with this. It's free. Every person in your family gets their own account. They get free email, docs, and since it's one domain name, collaboration's built in. And I'm going to talk about that more as well. So families can do this. Schools can do this. SLU could do this. I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world to me because it costs virtually nothing. Now, as far as setting up goes, I'm not going to walk through details. Number one, if I sat here and talked through every detail in that book, we'd be here days. So in terms of setting up, all I'm going to tell you is you go to that website, google.com/a/, and look around there, and if you have problems, find it because they move the links around, but sign up there for the standard edition or the premier edition or the education edition or whatever. And it walks you through the process. My book walks you through the process. But that's where you go to sign up at Google. Once that's done, though, you got to start setting up your DNS. So you do need control of your DNS. Now, again, I'm talking to guys. That's not a problem. Most everybody in here has either fiddled around with DNS or set up DNS or has their own DNS servers or something like that. But it ends up looking like that. You basically create CNAMEs for the different services, and by the way, those services can be whatever you want. You don't have to call it mail. You can call it, you know, email or whatever you want. You don't have to call it wiki. Google, in fact, says call it sites. Well, I said no. I'm not going to call it sites. I'm going to call it what it is. It's a wiki. So I used wiki as my CNAME, but it's real easy. You just point everything to ghs.google.com. That's all you do. So setting up the DNS is easy. The MX records, it's exactly the same for everybody. So the details I gave in the book and the details you're seeing here are what every single one of you guys would use if you were to sign up for this. So all you got to do is set up your CNAMEs and your MX records and your DNS, and you're done. You're pretty much done in terms of setting it up. The problem now becomes migrating. Now you have to migrate your old data to the new services. And I'm sure everybody in here has done that at least once, and it knows how much fun it can be. Right? It's not fun. It's never fun. So let's start. You've never done it?
No.
Because it's been you the whole time.
Right.
Right. Okay. Okay. Well, you've had to migrate customers' data, haven't you?
No.
Damn. Okay. We're just going to hold him down and beat him after this talk. He's got to feel some pain. So let's talk about migrating Gmail first. Because that's usually the thing that's, first of all, the most complicated, and secondly, the thing people are most concerned about. Now, if somebody says, I had people go, oh, it's no big deal, I'll just leave my old email here and I'll archive it. Okay, great. But most people don't want to do that. Most people want to move it into Gmail, so it's all there. Well, the first thing you got to do is you got to plan. You got to plan, you got to plan, you got to plan. So I go through extensively in the book, but the big thing I wanted to talk about is you have to make your email folder structure conform to that used by Gmail. What does that mean? And I'm going to tell you guys some stuff over the next 5 minutes. Some of you guys are going to freak out. Okay? And I'm just asking you, don't freak out till you've heard me out. Okay? Some of you guys are immediately going to go, no, no, no. Just hear me out. Let me talk for a minute, and then you can freak out. Here's the deal. You have folder structures in Gmail. Now, Gmail doesn't call them folders, it calls them labels. Okay? When Gmail first came out, 4 years ago, you had one level. That was it. They have now added the ability to have two levels. That's it. Two levels. So that means I have friends that have folders inside folders inside folders inside folders inside folders inside folders inside folders. You can't do that. No working. Okay? Nope. Yep, it's the 21st century. Are you still using Netscape 4? Oh, God. Oh, God. So, in other words, you can have friends, and you can have friends slash Jackie, but you can't have friends slash Jackie slash Project N. Everything has to be at two levels. That's it. Okay? Now, as I said, don't freak. Because the thing is, I go into this in the book. Number one, studies have shown over and over again that actually folders are a hindrance to how people use email, finding email, and so on. Number two thing studies have shown about folders. People end up, and I know a lot of you guys are going to have, an automated system.
Are you recording these studies in your
book? Yeah, the studies are in the book. Okay. I definitely have URLs in there. The other problem with folders is a very big problem, and that is, let's say that Stan sends me a message about my talk at SLUG, and I have three folders. I've got a SLUG folder, I've got a speaking folder, and I've got a Stan folder. Well, the problem is, once I put that email into one of those folders, it ate in the other folders. So I'm like, oh, I need to find out that email from Stan about speaking at SLUG, and I click on the SLUG folder, nothing. Okay, where'd I put it?
Well, that's
speaking.
That's not the folder problem.
But that's a byproduct of folders because you can only put an email in one folder. That's my point.
You don't have design directory.
Yeah. I would argue that's a problem of folders that you can only put an email in a folder. Where with Gmail, you have labels, and with labels you can attach as many labels as you want to an email message. So I could get an email message and attach Stan, SLUG, and speaking to it. And then, when I click on the Stan label, it shows me all emails, messages with that label associated with it. If I click on SLUG, it shows me all messages with that associated with it. If I click on speaking, it shows me all messages with that label associated with it. So number one, labels are more powerful than folders. But the final reason that you shouldn't freak out and should try to embrace this is, trust me, I've been using Gmail now since just about a month after it came out. You will start searching for everything. The problem with most email searches, it's painfully slow, and it's not very sophisticated. Well, remember, we're dealing with Google here. So when you are searching Gmail, you are using Google's search. So it's super fast, it's super powerful, and so I'm going to go over all the details about those searching. So ultimately, I will tell you what I did. I had all these subfolders and subfolders, and after using it for about a year, I was like, you know, this is stupid, I don't need these. I just searched for everything anyway, and so I just started making big buckets that I just put everything in, and I'll go over some of those buckets with you. And again, it's nerve-wracking at first if you've been using folders inside folders inside folders, but trust me, it's easy once you do it to let go of, because it really will make sense to you. The problem is, there are some automatic migration tools out that are like, oh yeah, we'll copy your Outlook folders structure straight up to Gmail, no problem. But when they're too stupid, these programs don't warn you about this two-level limitation. I actually had a friend use one of these tools, and it migrated all of them up. But the problem was, Google only saw the first two levels. So he couldn't search for a bunch of... He would search, but results would come up nothing, because they literally didn't see that. So you just got to beware of those automatic migration tools to do that.
The search didn't see it, or they weren't there?
The search didn't see it.
But they were there.
They were there.
No.
But the search didn't see it. And the problem was you really couldn't get to them. They were in, like, if you connect, it's complicated. But they were there, but Google was having trouble seeing them, which meant it couldn't search for them. So don't do it.
Instead, tag by label.
Well, I'll go over how to do it correctly, how to migrate. So there are two ways to migrate. You can migrate manually. This is email. Or you can migrate using a two-way synchronization program, which is what I recommend. Manually, though, is a good way to start with. Here's how you do it manually. Now, everybody in here knows the difference between POP and IMAP, right? I don't need to cover POP and IMAP, right? Okay? Because Google supports accessing your Gmail via POP and, as of about a year ago, IMAP. And I recommend IMAP. Use IMAP. Don't use POP. Use IMAP. So what you do is, all you do is, you create your, you set up your Google Apps account, you access through the web interface your Gmail account, and you enable IMAP. You then connect to that IMAP account in your mail client of choice. Now there's going to be nothing there. Okay? Right, because there's nothing there. And then what you do, you start manually copying folders and messages up. Now, that is the easiest way in terms of, you can tell anybody, connect, drag, copy. Now, there are advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is it preserves all your metadata. If you drag either by a folder up or by select messages and drag them up, all your metadata, the from, the headers, the dates, the times, all that stuff will be preserved, which I know all of you want. Mm-hmm. Also, you're in full control. If you're like, oh, you know what? I don't need these 10 messages from Uncle Joe, or I don't need this. I'll just archive it. You're in control of that. So you can kind of pick and choose what you do. Finally, automatic labeling. If you create a label at Gmail titled clients, in your mail client, you're going to see what it thinks is a folder called clients. If you grab email out of an old account and drag it into that, Google automatically labels any message that goes into that folder with the label of clients. In other words, Google maps your email client maps Gmail labels to folders. Does that make sense? So it does automatic labeling. Now, there are disadvantages to doing this method. Number one, it takes a long time, depending on how many messages you have. In my case, I had thousands and thousands, and so I would basically do a folder at a time, and then while it was in the background, I'd work. And then I would check it. Okay, that's done. Grab the next folder and do it. I spent hours and hours doing that, but you know, I got it done. It wasn't that bad. Now, I know some of you guys are hoarders. Okay? You're in for a long, long time doing this. But most people, it shouldn't be horrible, but it's going to take some time. It's tedious. Select, copy, work, check. Okay, it's done. Select, copy, work. So it's tedious, but you'll get it done. The one thing you got to know that'll keep you from getting confused is that Gmail collapses threads into what it calls conversations, where it groups them by subject. So if Phil and I send 10 emails back and forth about Stan's hat, okay? In an email client, it would say 10 messages. Google would say, no, that's one conversation that has 10 messages in the conversation. So the confusing part would be, you transferred 5,000 messages, then you log into Gmail and go, there's only 2,000 conversations, what happened? Well, no, there's 5,000 messages. It's not calling them messages. How do you make sure? Well, in your client, in your desktop client, it doesn't know about conversations, so it's going to say 5,000 messages. Does that make sense to you guys? So I'm just trying to prevent you from getting confused.
I like the last one.
Don't panic. That's right. Now, their better way is to sync this stuff. Do it automated. You know, automate this process. If you use the Premier or Education editions, you can use Google's free IMAP migration tool if the server the mail's now on is an IMAP server. If it's not an IMAP server, you're out of luck. But if it is an IMAP server, and remember, Exchange will support IMAP, it's just most Exchange admins I've met don't know how to spell IMAP, you know, they don't even know, and they always give us this crap that it's a security hazard. I mean, I've heard that so many times. If you go to Microsoft's documentation on their website, they're like, you can turn on IMAP, but it's not mappy, so it's kind of a security hazard, which is completely, utterly ridiculous. But if the server that the mail is currently on is an IMAP server, and you're using the Premier or Education, it's simple. Super simple. You just point it at it, and Google just sucks everything in. Really easy. Yes, sir?
Well, actually, Microsoft has changed their tune.
Really?
They dropped mappy in favor of IMAP.
When?
So, imagine that.
When?
It's been fairly with
like Exchange 2007.
Yeah, there's no mappy in 2007. There is in 2003, but not in 2007.
Mm-hmm. On the Exchange server.
I don't know about the Exchange server, but my Outlook.
Oh no! They've always supported IMAP and Outlook. Trust me, Mappy is their default.
Right, but it's not anymore in the servers. I will double check.
Please double check. Now, let's say you have mail and inbox files, which I know a lot of you guys do. Again, I don't need to go into inbox and mail dir, right? Everybody knows the difference and what they are, right? Okay? If you've got a bunch of mail and inbox files, which you guys probably do, a lot of you guys, there's actually a Ruby script. Hey, Ed, there's a Ruby script. Surprised Ed doesn't write one now to compete with it while I'm giving this talk. So there's a Ruby script called toGmail, and I give the URL to locate it and all that stuff in the book. But the format of it is you type toGmail.rb, then your inbox file, then the Gmail folder or label you want to point it to or put it into. And then, this is cool, if you actually get interrupted, you can actually tell it to start in the inbox file with the number of the next mail message, which is cool, so you don't end up with duplicate messages, but that's obviously optional.
What number?
Whatever number you stopped at.
You mean sequence number.
Yeah, sequence number, right. And so in my case, I gave an example there. I would type toGmail.rb, WebSanity would be the name of the inbox file that my WebSanity mail is in, and I want to put it into work/WebSanity@Gmail. I run the script and it just copies everything into it. Preserves the metadata, all that good stuff. It's great. If you use Thunderbird, and I know probably a lot of you guys use Thunderbird, if you install the webmail extension, you can actually migrate your email from other web services. Yeah. So if you use Yahoo or Hotmail or Gmail or AOL or a bunch of others, you install that. First of all, if you're not interested in Gmail tonight, you can install that extension and now read your webmail in Thunderbird. But let's say you've got some email up at Yahoo or wherever, you can now create an account in Thunderbird with that extension. You can now see all your Yahoo mail, and you can then copy it up to Gmail, and that way migrate your mail from your previous webmail service to this one. Other solutions for webmail include FreePops, YPops, and if you're using a Mac, MacFreePops. So there are others. Again, I give you URLs and all that stuff. There's also a really cool extension for Thunderbird that works, and therefore works on Mac, Linux, and Windows, called the Mail Redirect extension. And you can actually set that up, and it'll automatically start sending mail for you, redirecting it. So the headers are slightly changed, but it does keep a lot of the header information, so that's good. But there, you can use that as well. So the point is, there's a variety of ways that you can migrate your mail automatically from your current system to Gmail. Or you can do it manually. It's up to you. Or you can mix and match, whatever you're comfortable with. In terms of migrating contacts, there are two ways to import. You can import manually via a CSV file containing your contacts. That is it. That is the only format Google will accept, is a manual import. It must be a CSV file. Or you can use two-way synchronization software. Now, there's some gotchas. Number one, records must have unique email addresses. In other words, if you had Stan with his email and his wife didn't have email, so you had Stan's wife as a separate contact with Stan's email, Google's going to go, no. You got to have unique email addresses for each record. So you have to take Mrs. Stan and just blank her email out. Not everybody has to have an email, but every email has to be unique. Does that make sense? Okay. Next, you can only upload 3,000 contacts at a time. You can do it multiple times, but you can only do 3,000 at a time. The reason I say about 3,000 is, that's a very rough estimate. If you have, I have this friend Rich, who has been using Outlook for years and years, and I migrated him over to Google. He was using the contacts part of Outlook as like a mini customer resource management tool. Every time he talked to anybody on the phone, met with them, had lunch with them, did a deal with them, he would put the date and time and a note in the notes field. There were some people, I would look at the contacts, and there were hundreds of lines of details about certain people. Well, guess what? He can't upload 3,000 contacts. He can maybe do 500 at a time because he's got so much detail in there. So 3,000 means 3,000 if you haven't been putting, note after note after note after note. So don't freak if you try to do 3,000, it's refused. Keep reducing it, and you'll get to the magic number.
So how many contacts did he have?
Oh, couple thousand?
Not even 3,000.
Not even 3,000.
That's what I mean, for a guy, who knows 3,000 people?
Yeah.
Even for a guy who uses his contact book for every person he's ever met in his whole life, who knows 3,000?
He is basically he took over his dad's company. And so he's running the company, and he does sales all over the world.
Yeah, I guess that would be one place. Like within a large corporation, right. You may have 100,000 employees.
Right. Yeah. Now, if you're migrating the employees as the administrator, I go through extensive details about how to do a bulk upload of user accounts, because that would be a case of user accounts, and Google completely supports all that. That's not a big deal. And you also can't transfer groups or lists if you do it manually, because the CSV file there's no fields in there to keep track of groups and lists and so on. So you'd have to manually recreate those at Google or use the automated method. So in terms of CSV, what's cool about it is that Google tries to work with the default exports of most CSV files, but you can massage it if you want. But you'd be surprised. In writing the book, I did a lot of experimentation where I would go into most programs and just do an export and then see if Google accepted it. And most of the time, Google would accept it. But if you're anal retentive or you want to make sure of some stuff, you can actually open it up in a spreadsheet, open it up in OpenOffice or Google Spreadsheets, and you can massage the data and change column headers and move data and add data and so on. The thing about it is, though, before you try to migrate 1,000 or 2,000 people or whatever, test it with about 10. So if you're going to do a CSV file upload, man, get that down to 10 people and test that first, because otherwise it'll save you time, it'll save you headaches. Do that first. The most basic CSV file, you could actually create a CSV file with two headers, name and email, and your Google will take it. Okay? You could do that if you want. What you really ought to do, though, is log in to your Google Contacts, create a contact, and fill in every single field, okay, uniquely. Don't put the same number in it over and over for phone, because that won't help you. And then export that to a CSV file, and you'll have exactly what Google uses by default. Now, I actually give you all the fields in the book. I did that, and then list them all in a bulleted list, so you could just look at that. But the other way is, if you do that, you've already got your spreadsheet headers right there, and you can just start importing the data and massaging it. Okay? Now, if you use Evolution and you want to export to a CSV file, that's the command you run. Evolution actually comes with a command built in on the command line that lets you export, and there is wrapping. That dash should be in front of the format. If you use K Address Book, you just go to File Export, choose CSV. And there you go. If you use Thunderbird, go to your address book, go to Tools, Export, choose CSV. And then once you have the CSV file, you go to Google Contacts and click on the import link. Done. So manually importing contacts isn't that big a deal. It's pretty easy. But I'm lazy. I know a lot of you guys are lazy. Lazy's a good thing when we're talking about computers. You can also sync it. There's a bunch of different software I go over in the book. These three are ones I'd recommend. Plaxo is actually a web-based service that will take care of all the syncing. It'll sync your Apple address book and Outlook. The reason I gave Outlook is because I know some of you guys are in corporate settings and have to deal with Outlook. If you use a Mac, Spanning Sync is the $30 piece of software that's awesome. I use it constantly. It does just constant syncing. So anytime I change a contact, it trickle syncs it up to Google, and anytime I change to Google, it trickle syncs it down. For $30 a year, I was like, that's cool. So all my contacts were always in sync. Or if you use Thunderbird, Zendesk Teep Thunderbird Calendar Sync does syncing also. So I go through all this stuff, but there are ways to do automated syncs where you start out with an empty address book at Google, and you install this software, and it syncs it all up to Google. And that way you don't even have to mess with the CSV file at all. But if you want to go through the data, make sure the data is clean, sometimes looking at it in spreadsheet format, you can sort easier and see things and kind of prune people out and fix stuff, you might want to do it. Then you could use the CSV method. Now, in terms of migrating calendar data, again, there's two ways to migrate. Manually, Google supports two formats, the iCal format and CSV. Or you can do a two-way sync using software. Now, in terms of the manual, there's some gotchas with CSVs. Main one is recurring events. If you use CSV and you have a recurring event, it becomes a series of individual events, which means if you log into Google Calendar and try to change the time,
it's only going to change it for the event you chose, not all of them. Does that make sense? Which is a pain. So my advice is, don't use the CSV format unless you absolutely have to use the CSV format. Use the iCal format instead. If you use Apple's iCal, you go to File Export, you now have an iCal file. Apple brilliantly named their calendar program after the standard, which means use iCal to export into iCal, which is nice. If you use Evolution, I don't know what these people are smoking. There's no export in Evolution. There is a bug file against that. I actually give you the bug number and the URL to check the bug in the book, which is retarded. I don't know why they haven't put, I mean, it's 2008, you know. Novell is behind this. Get an export in there. That's ridiculous.
Because it's going to lock customers in.
But no, it doesn't, because you can just go to the calendar ICS file in your home directory, and right. There it is. So there's no lock-in. It's just laziness. On the part of the developers. It's not like it's in some weird format. It's in ICS. So there's your ICS file, your iCal file right there. So just copy it and ship it up. KOrganizer, File Export iCalendar. If you use Thunderbird, go to File Export Calendar. You're done. Go to Google. Go to Import. You've now imported your calendar data. That's the manual method. Not painful at all, but again, I'm lazy. You can sync it. Schedule World is a web-based service, runs on Mac, Windows, Linux, and it supports syncing your Google Calendar data with Apple's iCal, Evolution, Thunderbird, and Outlook. Spanning Sync, which I just mentioned, is the $30 piece of software. Not only syncs contacts on Macs, but also does calendar data. And I swear by it. It's what I use it every day. GCal Daemon is basically a proxy server you set up on your machine. It requires Java. And it therefore runs on all the OSs, and it supports syncing with Gmail, with Google Calendar, and iCal, Evolution, and Thunderbird. By the way, when I say Thunderbird, you guys all know I mean Thunderbird with the Lightning extension installed, which gives calendaring, or Sunbird, which is Mozilla's standalone calendar. Lightning is just Sunbird integrated into Thunderbird. Now, Thunderbird 3 just came out in beta, like yesterday, and I installed it on my Mac and was playing with it today briefly. I think they're supposed to integrate Sunbird directly in. So Thunderbird 3, I think, is going to have calendaring just built in, I believe. So in that case, that's just Thunderbird.
That's what I've been reading.
Is it going to integrate it? Yeah.
Integrated.
It's going to be a nice update. Provider is a Thunderbird extension that also syncs the calendar if you have Sunbird installed, Lightning installed. So you've got a bunch of different automated solutions available to you, some free, some inexpensive, that you can use to sync your calendar data on your machine with your Google Calendar. So you've now migrated your email, your contacts, your calendar over. Now let's start talking about some of the tips and tricks about using this stuff. And let's start with Gmail. Now, for those of you who've never looked at Gmail before in your life, and I don't know what rock you've been sleeping under, but that's what Gmail looks like. Now, I actually took that screenshot about 2 hours ago or so, and I'd like you guys to look at that. And does anybody here use Gmail? Does anybody notice anything about this?
How do you get your labels on the right?
You're going to find out. Do you notice anything else?
Calendar down.
Yep, I've got Google Calendar appearing. I've got Google Docs appearing here. I've got this here, and look at that.
Tasks.
Google rolled out Tasks 2 days ago. So Tasks are now integrated into Google and into Gmail.
I think that with your Palm Pilot.
You know, but I don't use a Palm Pilot. I use the vastly superior iPhone.
Is there anything else you can say?
So what I do with my 14 years worth of history in a Palm Pilot?
Export it to a usable format, and I import it into Google. It doesn't support any export into usable formats?
CSV isn't going to work, because I got 1,000 recurring events in there.
Man, I don't know. Does the desktop client for Palm Pilot support any sort of export into usable things? I'd look. Somebody must have written something at this point. You'd think. Somebody would. Somebody else had a question? Yes, Ed.
Not a question, but a comment.
Go ahead.
So, if you want to have some fun, go to the settings page on Gmail,
uh-huh.
And then look over to the right.
Hey, stop, Ed.
What?
Stop.
Are you going to talk
yes,
about,
stop.
About Labs?
Stealing my thunder?
Okay.
Sure.
Well, I just want to
come
talk,
on.
I just want to talk about one.
Well, I'm getting to it. I'm going to go
Are
through all
sure?
of them. I'm going to go through all of them.
Every single one?
Yes, every single one. Hold on.
Right.
Hold on. So that is a... Yes, go ahead.
So if I already... Just going back to the other. Mm-hmm. If I already have a Gmail account and I want to have my own domain name, do
yes.
I have to do all this importing and
everything? Yep. Okay. But it's easy. Because you set up IMAP in your Gmail, and then you tell Gmail to import the stuff from it, and it just imports it right in there.
Okay.
I go through that in there, too. I didn't go over that, because, again, I had to pick some stuff to leave out for this talk. But, yeah, that's actually pretty easy.
Okay.
Yeah. So let's talk about the settings in Gmail. So you go to the settings, and it's so nice talking to you guys, because a lot of people I talk to, have you ever noticed, like, normal people never go into the preferences or settings of programs? Like, they're afraid to or something? That's the first thing I do when I get a new program, is click on preferences and start going through everything. Look, what can I do?
So, the background on their screensaver.
Love that. So let's look at some of the settings, which are the cool stuff. So number one, I'm skipping a bunch of stuff, but labels. I was talking to you guys earlier about labels, which are Google's replacement for folders. And this shows you, I've got the two levels right here. And what I did is, for my top level folders, I use all caps, and I made it really short. Because you'll notice back on this page, the labels show up on the right side, and normally they're on the left side, but that width of that green box is set. When I first started using Gmail, I had labels named like, Clients/Third Baptist Church. Well, what got displayed was Clients/Third Bap. Right? And there's nothing you could do about it. So when I redid my labels a year or two later, what I did was I made the first tier all caps and three letters or four letters. And then I put the longer thing inside that so I have a nice short first level. Does that make sense? Visually, that's just some hard-earned experience I'm sharing with
so
you guys.
So where's the first level and second level over there?
The first level would be CMS, then help and main would be the subfolders in your client. In other words, if you were to view in Thunderbird and connect to my Gmail, mm-hmm. you would see a folder called CMS, and you'd see two subfolders, one called help and one called main.
Perfect, CMS.
Right there. Are here, list, thank you. List, Grana, list Linux, list politics, list tech, list Unix tip, list web dev, and you would see a top level folder called list with what? Eight subfolders.
But there's no top level folder.
That's because this is labels. Remember, your client maps labels into folders because clients, desktop clients, don't understand labels.
But Gmail has no folders in it.
Right, Gmail has labels.
And so they're all labels.
Yes.
This thing about two level of folders is just artificial.
Right. It's artificial.
It's all labels.
Yes. And everything is labels.
And that's the same in Google Apps.
Yes. So Gmail and Google, everything is labels in
so
Gmail.
Basically, you can create three or four levels of folder if you can figure out how to name it in that space.
No, you can't. Gmail will not let you. If you created a label, here's how you create a second level label. You put a slash. So in other words, if you had Omnitech and stopped, right, you could also then create another label called Omnitech/clients. And Google will allow you to do that. The slash is what denotes the separator.
Okay.
But if you tried to create Omnitech/clients/Stan, it'll be like, nope, can't do it. So that's how it prevents you. Yeah.
I'm thinking, I understand what Lee was going for. If there isn't a distinction, I mean, whether or not you're putting a slash, a dash, or whatever, if it's just using the label as a tag and there is no top level.
The slash is what acts as the separator.
Right, but I mean, since there's nothing in what you see, what you can use,
but there's no
you
way
never
to
get an access to a top level label.
Yeah, you can. Look, I have. Let's see. The way I did it is I could have created a label just called PER and stopped. Even though I have PER/carry, PER/entertain, PER/.
So you're saying the reason there is no folder label there is because you didn't create one.
Right.
And if you did create one, you could select the list folder label and just see the messages in that.
In list, and that's a separate folder. If I clicked on list, if I did have one, I could create one called list, and it would go right here, right? If I clicked on it, though, I'm not going to see all this. I'm only going to see stuff that is explicitly labeled with list.
But then it's not a two-level thing.
It's an artificial construct.
Right. It's an artificial construct.
But if you're using, but if there's nothing under it except the things that you've explicitly put under it. If the secondary levels aren't under it, then
they are under it in your client, on your desktop client. In other words, if you opened it in Thunderbird, you would see a top level folder called list, and underneath it you would see. Okay. Now, in fact, you will see a top level folder called list regardless, because there is one here with a slash after it.
Okay.
So if you were to view my account in Thunderbird, you would see list with a plus next to it. You click on the plus, it would expand, and you would see Civic DLS Grana. You would not see list/DLS, list/Civic. Now I've learned I will take a screenshot of this and show. I have one in the book, and I didn't do it. I should have done that. That would have made it clearer. So I apologize for the confusion. Once you do it, it makes more sense.
Well, it's just a mapping between Gmail and the client.
Right.
And it's your client where you have the two-folder limitation.
Right. No. You have your client. You could create multiple levels of folders until the cows
come. The client can't display more than two folders from Gmail because Gmail doesn't tell it.
Gmail doesn't allow you to create more than two levels. Right. Right. Yes, sir.
If you have an email with a big attachment and you give it multiple labels, and your client's going to suck it down multiple times and store it in multiple folders on your client?
Well, first of all, that depends if you're using POP or IMAP.
Oh, I see what you said.
If you're using not POP, yeah, that might happen. That's one of the, don't use POP. I mean, nobody should be using POP in 2008 anyway. You know, IMAP is where we should all be.
So with IMAP, it's just going to download the headers.
Right, it's going to download the header. Unless, like for instance in Thunderbird, you can say, just download the message every single time for offline use. Kmail allows you to do the same thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, for offline use.
And then it would.
Yeah, it's going to.
But remember, you can do that by folder too. You can say, always download the contents of this folder for offline use, but not this one and this one. That depends on your email client. Different email clients have more granular ability to
There's
do that.
There's only one. Thunderbird.
Thunderbird, okay. I like Thunderbird. So getting back to the labels, so I was trying to show you guys the labels, how I've structured it there. Again, WRI, anything to do with writing is how I did that. That's just my advice. I mean, of course, you're free to do whatever you want. I'm just saying what I learned over time was to kind of really narrow down. And even WRI or just writing would probably be good enough, and I could dump everything in that. I used to have like 125 labels, and I just realized this is dumb. I just don't need it. Like web dev, I don't know if you saw it, but I have list web dev. That's like five or six different listservs getting dumped into the same label because I can just search on it. So you don't need all the multiple levels. Now, filters allow you to automate what happens to certain emails, whether they get deleted or automatically filtered or automatically labeled or whatever. And these are some of my filters. I'd like you to notice the construct of how they operate. Matches from admin, subject colon, frontier restarted, or subject colon, summary report, or subject colon. And again, I go through that in the book. It's kind of a unique way of doing it, but once you figure it out, it's pretty easy. But you can have pretty complex filters up there that combine. As you see, I've got froms and subjects. You can have the contents of a message be part of the filter, the to down there. So you can see a whole bunch of different ones. Here's some more that are complicated, a little more details in there. And then this one I thought some of you guys would find interesting, that top one there. If I get an email that has Hebrew or Russian in it, it goes immediately, just deleted immediately.
How do you get
the Cyrillic?
The symbols in there.
I copied it out of an email message and pasted it into the filter box, and it supports Unicode. Firefox supports Unicode, so it just did it perfectly. And that one right there cuts down an enormous amount of spam.
How do you come with the category of ethnic cleansing?
Might.
So which character do you pick?
I picked ones that didn't look like anything in English.
Okay.
Ones that were unique, that were like, nobody's going to send me an email with whatever those symbols are. I mean, those are just Russian symbols in Hebrew. Finally...
Do you have your own spam filters then, or is there other spam filtering that you go on?
Google is automatically spam filtering all the time, and it has excellent, excellent spam filtering. Probably the best I've ever used or seen. The filters are, for instance, well, let me show you how to set up a filter, then I'll go back to that if that isn't clear. So let's say you want to create a new filter. You can filter on the from, the to, the subject, has the words, doesn't have, or has attachments. Once you put it in, so in my case, I just typed in Robert Sitek. You could put an email address, you can put a person's name, whatever you want. Then you click the test search button. And it actually shows you there what the results are going to be, so you can verify it first that, yeah, this is getting the mail I want it to get. Then you click on next step, and these are your choices. You can just tell it, archive it. Don't even go into the inbox, just archive it. Mark it as red, star it, which, you know, is like flagging. Google calls it starring instead of flagging. Apply the label, so you can automatically apply the label. Forward it, delete it, or never send this to spam. So in the case of, you guys have all had that where you got a message that was mismarked as spam. This would stop that. If it's from Stan at slug.org, never send it to spam. You know, just stop spam filtering on that. Other than that, so I was so annoyed by certain ones that got through once or twice, like those bottom ones. You know, dentaltown.com kept sending me spam. And instead of waiting for Google to learn, because you click mark as spam, and it learns, right, using a Bayesian type of filter, and I just got impatient, and so I went ahead and created that. You don't have to do that, you know, right. But I was impatient on those particular jerks, and I got sick of getting email with penis in the subject, or check my wife or become a giant, so I just set it up to automatically filter it. Again, if I'd waited a couple more days and just kept clicking mark as spam, it would have happened automatically. So I used to use Procmail for my filtering, and I had the most enormous manual Procmail scripts you've ever seen. And once I switched to Gmail, I could just pretty much toss all of that, and because you don't need it, it does a great job by itself. So that's the filtering. Next is this. This is great. Not only does Google have automatic forwarding, that's nice, you know, that's cool, but look at that. It has POP and IMAP support for free. Yahoo charges you $25 a year to have POP access to your Yahoo mail. Google, free. IMAP, free. So all you got to do is log, and you can have both enabled at the same time. If you want to do a backup on one account and access your email and a client with another one, you can do that if you want. But there you go. You got POP and IMAP. It's that easy to do. It's great. Works really well. And I go back and forth. I even access my Gmail account on my iPhone using IMAP. And it works great. Now, Ed, at the top right is Labs. Labs are where... Google just introduced Labs, by the way, about 6 months ago or so. Google basically said, you know, we got all these really smart engineers. They're doing really cool stuff. But we can't really roll these things out as features because we don't know if people would like them or not. So let's call it Gmail Labs. It's experimental. Users can log in and enable what they want to enable, try stuff out, and so on. And so this is the, you can log in here, and that's where Task comes from. Task just came out 2 days ago, and it is, you have to go into Labs to enable it. But once you enable it, now you've got tasks available in Gmail. If you scroll down, you've got Quick Links, which basically is a saved search. So I created a search for everything unread, created it as a quick link, and now I just click on that link instead of having to type, you know, is unread in the search box, because unread is a label. It's a built-in label, just like starred is a built-in label, inbox is a built-in label, sent is a built-in label. You cannot delete those labels, okay? But you can search on them, because everything is a label, and everything is a search. So you can do that with quick links. Superstars allow you to have more than just the gold star. You can have a fixed width font if you want to go with a Monaco or a Courier or something like that for fixed width. custom keyboard shortcuts if you want to have your own. And Gmail has really good keyboard shortcuts. Okay, if you know Vim with JK and so on, man, you can use those in Gmail already built in the box. Okay, you can go up and down in your email with J and K, selecting it. It's really great. Mouse gestures, signature tweaks, custom date formats, old Snakey. So you can play a game of Snake in your email. It opens up on top of your email, and you can play Snake. Email Addict forces you every couple of hours, it blocks your access to Gmail for 15 minutes, forcing you to get off your butt and walk around. Right side chat, right side labels, that's how I did it. I went in there and just clicked that, and it moves the labels on the right side. Advanced IMAP controls, if you want to do that. Canned responses, in other words, vacation responses, or even not vacation, just canned responses. Default reply to all.
Someone who doesn't care.
You can drag the items in the nav bar. Mail goggles. There's a plight affecting our nation. We've all heard of drunk dialing, where people get drunk and make late night phone calls. Well, there's drunk mailing, where people get drunk and then send emails to their ex-girlfriends. I miss you still. Well, this, between certain hours of the night, forces you to answer really simple math problems before you can send an email. And it's called mail goggles, which is really funny.
I should have did that to Congress.
Yeah, or at least in Illinois. That's vacation, autoresponders, custom label cutter, colors, text messaging. You can now send and receive text messages in Google Chat, which is built into Gmail. Google Calendar, which I added, and Google Docs. So there's they're adding new ones like every couple of weeks. There's new ones. What Google's promised is the ones they see a lot of people use, they're just going to make a part of Google, a Gmail automatically. So if you want to play and test things out and kind of soup up your Gmail, go to the labs and check it out. Now, I talked about search. There's a search box at Gmail, and you can search on any of those headers.
Scott, you didn't mention the one I wanted to mention.
What's the one you want to talk about?
The thing that always annoyed me about Gmail was the fact that if you're looking at the main list of all your mail messages, and you want to like mark these as read without actually reading them, because a lot of times I want to do that, well, you got to go and select them, and then you got to go and hit the drop-down link.
And go to mark as read.
And mark as read. But there's a button in Labs that you can just push.
Right. So instead of having to select, click, click, you select and click, thus saving you that one click.
Yes, indeed. Well, one click and a drag.
Okay, so you're even lazier than I am.
Yeah, what a drag.
Very impressive. Very impressive. Very, very impressive, man. So you can search on any of those headers. You can search by attachment. You put has:attachment, file name, colon, and then you put the file type. You can do it by docs, movies, music, and pictures. And you can combine these. That's the other thing. Get it really granular. And then once you've got it really granular, you go into Labs and do that save searches thing. And now if you have a search you do all the time, there it is. You just click that, and it does it for you. You can also do labels. And I was so proud of this. I was noticing in my book, I actually put shortcut, shorter cut, shortest cut, and they actually left it in the book. I was so happy. Because I put little things in the book all the time, and they cut it out. They take it out because it's, you know, and they left that in. I guess they missed it. But you could search for label colon inbox, but I'm among lazy Unix guys. So instead, you can put in inbox. But hell, let's get even lazier. You can just put L colon inbox or L colon caret I. And that'll do the same. So you got four different ways of searching in the inbox, starred, sent, spam, virtually everything. You can usually do these custom little quick searches. You can even search by time.
How does F equal sent?
Because S was spam. That's why. Yeah. I had to pick something. I noticed that too today. You can do by time, after, and then you use the ISO format for the time, or before. And you can use Booleans and symbols to, again, combine your search terms. So you can do and, which is the default. You don't need to put and. So space is and. You can use the pipe or the dash or not, or you can use quotes for phrase searching as well. It's incredibly powerful, and trust me, guys, once you really start using this, you're going to be like, man, why would I want to use a desktop client for this more complex stuff? It's so much easier. Let's talk about integrating Gmail into your desktop clients. You can read Gmail via POP or IMAP, Apple Mail, Evolution, KMail, Thunderbird, and Outlook. I mean, pretty much anybody. Any client can read Gmail using POP or IMAP. You can even do it on your iPhone or your BlackBerry. I have a whole section of the book. I have a whole section of the book out. What if you want to make Gmail your default mail client on Windows so that when you click an email link, it opens in Gmail in your browser? And I tell you how to do that in the Mac. Well, I also tell you how to do that in Linux in the book in detail, and I'll go through it real quick with you guys. In Firefox, you go to About Config, and you set Network Protocol Handle or External Mail to True. You then write that script. So you create that script. Now, rather than make you guys scribble, I just uploaded it to my website, and that URL is actually in the book. So in the book, I say, hey, don't copy this. Just go to this URL and download it. So you get that script, you save it, and then shamat it so it's executable. Then in GNOME, you set it up and point to that script. In KDE, you point to that script, you're done. Now, in Linux, anytime you click on an email link in anything, it will automatically open up in your web browser in Gmail, if you want to do that. So that's in there as well. Let's talk about contacts. This is what Gmail contacts look like. Gmail contacts, frankly, are pretty lame. They're not great. They're better, but they're still not great, which is why I never enter anything directly into Gmail contacts. I do it in my desktop client to sync it up. I could enter stuff in here, but it's pretty lame. The big thing I want to point out to you about it is, and this is so stupid of them, and this does fall into the we're going to make it hard, really annoys me, you can't delete more than 20 contacts at a time. Mm-hmm. It's great. So that's
safety
one of the
feature.
Huh?
It's a safety feature.
Yeah, that's what they said.
It's malice.
It's really annoying. So when I was writing this book, I would routinely upload hundreds of contacts and then go, I got to get rid of all of them. Well, I did some research, and again, I go in the book. This is great. I love how they do this. In the upper right, there's a link to older version, and that's the older version of Gmail, which includes the older version of the contact manager, which allows you to nuke everybody at one time. So, if any of you guys ever want to delete more than 20 contacts in Gmail's contacts, go to the older version, go to contacts,
select, take the handcuffs off.
Select everybody. That's right, you're typing RM without a dash I, and delete, and then go click, it now says newer version, click on newer version and go back in. So that's how to get around that annoyance. I just wanted to make sure I mentioned that because it is a big annoyance. Let's talk about the calendar. That's what Gmail's calendar looks like. Google Calendar. Google Calendar is awesome. This is the I love Google Calendar. I use it every day. It's phenomenal. You can have multiple calendars. You can subscribe to other people's calendars. And when you click on them, like I've done here, they are interleaved over your calendar data. So my good buddy, Jans Carton, has a six-year-old girl, and his wife has Google Calendar. He has Google Calendar, and they set up a Google Calendar for their daughter that he manages. His wife and daughter appear on the side. When his wife logs into her Google Calendar, her husband and daughter appear on the side, and they can click it and see who's got to be where when to pick up the kid or take the kid to her piano lessons or whatever. So again, for families, it's great. For small businesses, it's great. This is a great exchange replacement in that way because you know who's busy, what they're going to be doing, and so on. So it's just fantastic. If you notice those little drop-down arrows to the right of My Calendar, there, when you click on those, you can say, display only this calendar, go to settings, create events, share this calendar, or even change the color. I wanted to show you guys this. You can share calendars with other people, which is how I was subscribing to all those calendars down there. I've subscribed to people's calendars, And that's how you do it. You can share it, make it public, and you can give people either just free busy, where they can see you're busy but they don't know what you're doing, or they have full access and can see the details of what you're doing. There's the list of people that I've given access to, and so I've said they can see all the details, no big deal. But you can even allow people to change stuff on your calendar. So it's, again, really granular. In terms of integrating Google Calendar, if you go to Calendar Details, you can embed a calendar into a website so people can see it. You can also notice Google gives you a public address in XML, iCal, and HTML format, and a private address in XML, iCal, and HTML format. If you know those addresses, if you just right-click on there and get the address, you can set up read-only access in your desktop calendar. So, in Evolution, that's how you would do it. In iCal, that's how you would do it. In KOrganizer, that's what you would do. In Sunbird or Thunderbird with Lightning, that's what you could do. And now you have read access. Now, that means Google Calendar is the master. If you want to add, edit, or delete events, you've got to log into Google Calendar to do it. Why would you want to do this? Because now you have offline access to your calendar, number one. But number two, you can sync it, and I'll get to that in one sec. Yes?
We have, I have set up our calendar on our school website using this, and I've got those addresses at the bottom of the page.
Yep. So people can subscribe to it themselves.
They can subscribe to it.
And it shows up in their calendar.
They can show up on their desktop.
Yep.
They don't even have to log into
Their Google Calendar.
Or their Google
Calendar. Yep, exactly. Now, this is one example. Again, there's various syncing software. I went over them, that's why I'm not repeating myself. But Spanning Sync, again, runs on my Mac here. Spanning Sync connects my Apple iCal to my Google Calendar, and it's two-way. So if I update my desktop, it updates Google Calendar. If I update Google Calendar, it updates my desktop. And there's similar stuff for Linux, Windows, and so on. But I use an iPhone. The iPhone syncs up with iCal when I plug it in. So when I plug my iPhone in to my Mac, the iCal data gets synced. So I can, if I add something to my calendar here, it gets synced to here, which then automatically gets synced to here. If I add something here, it gets synced to here, which then gets synced to here. So I've basically got the same calendar on my handheld, my desktop, and out in the cloud, which is fantastic. Yeah?
Does it have to be Apple iCal?
No. Well, the iPhone requires either Outlook on Windows or iCal on the Mac. There's no official support from Apple for Linux. There may be somebody might have hacked something together.
But that's just the iPhone, doesn't it?
That's just the iPhone. The BlackBerry has similar stuff. Other smartphones will have similar stuff. In my book, to be honest, I pretty much stuck to the iPhone and the BlackBerry. Because I don't know anything about Windows Mobile. I don't want to know anything about Windows Mobile. I have no interest in writing or supporting Windows Mobile. And so I had to pick and choose, so that's what I picked.
Good choice.
Yeah. Now, you can also sync, as I said, and this is just a reminder of the syncing stuff. Now let's get to Google Docs. This is what Google Docs looks like. Google Docs allows you to have online word processing, spreadsheets, and presentations, and now forms, which I will talk about. It is very nice. If you go into it, however, expecting you're going to have every feature OpenOffice has or Word has, you're going to be extremely disappointed. It has hardly any of the features of those, but it has the features everybody uses. So, if you want to create a bibliography, you can't do it with this. But you can bold, you can align stuff, you can create links, you can add photos and things like that. Again, the 80-20 rule is definitely in play here. The stuff everybody needs to do and everybody does all the time, you can do in Google Docs. The really esoteric stuff, they're adding little tiny piece at a time. It has templates. If you guys notice right there where it says new, that little drop down that says new in the top left, when you click that, that's what you get. New document, new presentation, new spreadsheet, new form, new folder, or template. And there are now hundreds of templates that you can get available at Google Docs. And some of them are very, very, very useful and nice. Here's a list of some: a gas mileage log, a full wedding album, sales invoices, video Christmas cards, where you can take a video from YouTube that maybe your family's recorded and embedded in a Christmas card and send that URL out to people to go visit. A budget planner, presentation templates, pretty much anything you'd want. The other thing that Google Docs supports is Google Gears that allows you to go offline. So you can actually use Google Docs in offline mode. So in your laptop, you guys could be editing a Google Doc right now. When you went back, it would sync back up. You install the free Google Gears app, and it says offline right there. You click it, and it begins syncing, where it synchronizes your documents down in a local cache on your computer. And then you click, and it now says that little green check. If you click that little green check, it now syncs it back up. Pretty cool. And eventually they're going to roll that out to Gmail, Calendar, and everything else. So you'll be able to do offline syncing of anything you do in your Google Apps. At that point, Microsoft will crap itself, and I will be happy. Publishing and sharing. You can also share or publish your Google Docs. This is publishing. Check this out. You can. It gives a really weird address. You don't have any control over the URL. It's a very ugly, nasty URL, but it is now available to the world. Automatically republish when changes are made. That's really cool. So you can create a doc, and anytime you change it, you just hit save, and it automatically gets republished so people can see it. But the sharing and collaboration is the really killer app here. You can invite people as collaborators or viewers. And so if Stan and Nick and Lee were all collaborators, so Stan creates a doc at Google Docs and invites these two guys as collaborators, they can all three be at their own computers in different parts of the world, all looking at the same doc, all editing the same document at the same time. Lee will see Nick and Stan's edits as they appear. Nick will see Stan and Lee's edits as they appear. You can't edit the same line, obviously. But you can edit different parts of the document. My students use this all the time to collaborate. Love it. Awesome. So it's that easy to do. And if you're using a spreadsheet, you can have notifications sent to you when a cell changes. If you want to know when a specific cell changes, or if people are added, you can get an email letting you notifying you that a spreadsheet has changed. There are also powerful formulas and functions in Google Spreadsheets that will blow you away. One in particular, I was just like, wow, this is really cool. My buddy Jans has one of the most popular Dungeons & Dragons websites on the internet. I know. That is a table on his website. So that is a table that he created. It looks really nice because he's a CSS expert. That is a table on his website. Google supplies an import HTML function. You put that function, it looks like that, import HTML, and then you put a URL, query, index. A query is either list or table. So in Jans's case, in my spreadsheet, I would put import HTML and then the URL of the web page with that table. I would then say table, and then the number starts with 1, not 0, is the number of the table on the page. That table I just showed you was the first table. So I'm now pointing to the URL. I'm telling Google I want to focus on tables, and I want the first table. And you hit enter, and it inserts the contents of that table in your spreadsheet. Automatically.
Why do the numbers do that?
Because it thinks the formatting is the default formatting, so it's trying to guess. You know how numbers are kind of wooky in spreadsheets, unless you specify the type.
Like plus makes it a string as well.
Right. So you can always select those and then align as are selected. I was just showing you guys the default. But isn't that cool that you can do that? I mean, again, they're really leveraging the web-based nature of this software.
Now, is this one time, or will it update?
I believe it updates. I said in the book what it does, and I can't remember if it updates or not. I think it does, but I can't remember. The problem is, if he adds a table in front of that, right? Well, that table is now, because it's table one.
Yeah.
So, you again, it's all...
You can't be explicit in the name.
No, there's no... You can't use an ID identifying the table. You have to use the order.
So they can't redesign their page.
If they redesign it, you got different data. Yeah.
There should be an option that says update or don't update.
There might be. I wrote that months ago. Forms, guys, this is fantastic. If you ever have to create forms online for people to fill out, they're a pain in the rear. Google makes it easy. Again, you go to that new, you go to form, it looks like this. You title the form, you include data, you fill in the information there, and then you just click, you keep clicking add question at the top. You can reorder it by dragging the different question types or text, paragraph text, which is a text box, multiple choice, check boxes, choose for a list, or scale. And you set the number. So you can say scale 1 to 10, and these little radio buttons appear. So you can say, on a scale of 1 to 5, how would you rate blah, blah, and then they can click it. You can then publish that spreadsheet. Again, at Google's URL. It's not a pretty URL, but who cares? You can give the URL to people. When they fill it in and hit submit, the data automatically goes into a Google spreadsheet on your account in your list of docs that Google automatically creates. That's cool. But if you click on more detail, which is cut out of this down here, it actually graphs it for you.
No.
So you get these really pretty graphs showing you the data. See complete responses takes you back to the spreadsheet. So my point is, if you got to create a form, so my student evaluations that I create for my students, I just do it in this now. Say, log on to this URL, fill it out. In fact, that's what this is. That's what that was. That's from a student evaluation that the students filled out. That was an experiment I was doing. But it's so easy to do and makes it drop dead simple for the end users and for the people that have to design the forms and then track the data. Donald, what are you going to say?
You could use tiny URL to hide the ugliness.
Yeah, you sure could use tiny URL or map it in your own domain name with a redirect of some sort. In terms of integrating, OpenOffice, you can actually use OpenOffice to open up Google Docs. So if you have a doc in Google, you can open it in OpenOffice, or you can save your OpenOffice documents up to Google and store them up there. This is a picture of what OpenOffice to Google Docs looks like. There's the list, and you can see open in browser or open via browser. Works out really well.
What's the difference?
And it's in the book. I don't remember. I wrote about it in the book because I was confused. I thought the developer did not have very clear wording there.
Right.
It's in there. If you use Firefox, there are three ways you can integrate Firefox with your Google Docs. There's a Send to Google Docs extension. You right-click on a link to a Word doc, and it opens it up in Google Docs. The Google toolbar for Firefox, not IE, just Firefox only, integrates Google Docs with your machine's Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, OpenOffice documents. And this one you got to get, the GDocsBar extension for Firefox. You sign in, and it creates a sidebar in Firefox listing all your Google Docs. When you click it, it opens in the browser so you can edit them. And you see that thing on the bottom? You can just drag files off your local file system onto that, and it automatically uploads them to Google Docs.
What about folders in Google Docs?
You can create folders in Google Docs.
Is there the same limitation?
No. And they're actually folders.
It's a different team.
Yeah, it's a different team. Yeah, they had labels and they switched to folders. Believe it or not, for docs. Interesting.
It's different.
I'm getting close to ending, so just give me a couple more minutes, please. I wanted to end with backing up. I'm a backup fanatic. I know most of you guys are backup fanatics as well. So I trust Google a lot, but hey, you never know. So it's good to have backups of your data. So how do you back up Gmail? Well, Getmail is a better fetch mail. If any of you ever tried to set up fetch mail, woohoo! Eric Raymond, man, the guy is not the best, easiest designer of stuff. Getmail, there's the URL. It's free and open source. It allows you to do either POP or IMAP over SSL, which is good because Google Gmail, you can only access it over SSL, which rocks. That is awesome. So you set up Getmail, and it'll automatically just sit there and pull down your mail into nice little inbox formats for you on your hard drive, on your local machine, so you've got a backup. Matt Cutts, who works at Google, wrote a great article, How to Back Up Your Gmail on Linux in 4 Easy Steps. He walks you through the whole dang thing, makes it as simple as possible, and, really great. Contacts, remember that synchronization, well, if you're synchronizing your contacts, you've got a copy on your computer at all times. So that's all you got to do there. Same thing with calendar, just synchronize it and you've got a copy of your calendar data on your machine. If you're really paranoid, every once in a while do a file export and you've got it back up that way. For docs, you're going to love this. I put this up here for you, Ed. I know you're also a Python, you know, interested in Python stuff lately. GDataCopier is Python scripts that you run on the command line, which means you can use cron to make it scriptable and automated. So this puppy will just keep backing, you know, every night at 3 a.m., it'll download all your Google Docs off of Google, and you got a local copy that you have access. Or you can do it manually. If you install GreaseMonkey for Firefox, which you should anyway, because GreaseMonkey is freaking awesome, and you install the GreaseMonkey script Google Docs download, and you install the down-the-wall Firefox extension, basically you can do two clicks, and it'll automatically download manually all of your Google Docs.
You can't RSync
them?
No. No PBSCP access?
No. Nope. Sorry. You asked too much. How do you put, now, I didn't really talk about Google Sites much because of time, and also because, frankly, Sites is pretty weak, in my opinion. The wiki stuff is pretty, it's okay for very limited basic stuff, but it has a lot of work yet. But I did want to give you guys this because I knew you would appreciate it, if anybody would. In the book, and since I'm writing this book for general audiences, I spent like 4 pages explaining what wget is and all the different stuff about it. I just want to show you guys, if you run that, it backs up your wiki, your Google wiki, onto your local machine. And again, I knew you guys would appreciate this because you all know what wget is. And you know a damn fine command line string when you see it. So and of course, you'll notice the password isn't on there because, like all good, you know, security conscious people, we never put our password on the actual command line, because the history command will come back and bite you in the ass. So, of course, you create a .wget-rc file and put your password in that, and that way you're not exposing your password every night on your history when you run this. And that's it. If anybody has any questions... Oh, one thing I want to show you. The blog about the book is at www.1and100zeros.com. I was amazed that domain was available, but it is. So 1and100zeros.com is the blog where I'm going to be putting updates, fixes, errata. If you find an error, let me know. I'll put it up there too. News, things like that. I was going to be doing a lot more updating it this week, but babies are keep you busy, evidently. Nobody told me. So
this is the second time.
No, it's my first time.
Let's see. I thought you had 2 kids.
I have a dog. I like a baby. I treat it like a baby. So I'll be continuing to update it in the future as we go forward. Don?
The slideshow, where can we...
Stan will bother me tomorrow. He will start bothering me tomorrow about it. And I will post it on my S3. It's in Keynote format. I've got to convert it to PDF and QuickTime and all that. But I will post it on my S3 page so you guys can download away. Yes?
What about multiple domain names? That you want to use share the same.
The same? I think you can do that. I don't recall if I went over that, though, but I'm pretty sure you can do that.
You know, for example, my mom's family association, you've got a domain name, you only use one.
Right.
But the rest of them are aliased.
Right. And I think all you do is continue to do that alias thing where if somebody, you would tell people, the real domain that you would know would be at mail.lambert.com, right? But if somebody wants to go to mail.lambertfamily.com, it'll just redirect them to mail.lambert.com.
Okay, so we set up redirects on Google?
No, you have to set up redirects in your DNS.
Well, but it's gonna redirect you.
See, I take that back. You can have multiple domains in the admin interface you specify. Okay. You can do that in the admin interface. Yep. It's there. That screen I showed for admin, it's one, I think it's under account settings or domain settings. I think you can do it there. I'm pretty sure. Yes?
I'm thinking this leads to a security question, but you were leading into earlier that there's whistle.edu.
Mm-hmm.
There's a team out there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't have that kind of an email address, but what's to prevent me from creating a user account using that as a domain?
Well,
that team.
Well, when you do that, an email is going to be sent back to that address to validate who you are. So, okay. Unless you have access to that email address, I mean, I could try to create an account at BillG at Microsoft.com, but
they're going to send the verification email to BillG@Microsoft.com. You know what I mean? So since I don't have access to that email, it'll annoy him or his secretary, but I won't actually be able to create that account. In other words, all those accounts at Woostl are by people that in fact have woostl.edu email addresses.
What, is the effort that sends the email, does it have to respond before it actually creates the account? You have to go to your email and respond to that email?
I believe so. Unless you're the admin. Now, if you're the admin and you've logged in and you're bulk adding, obviously you don't have to because you're already in. And you're just creating the accounts. But when you do the initial sign up, you have to verify that you are who you are. You even have to verify, now that's only for the team edition. Everybody else, you have to verify that you have control of that domain name. And that's why if Lee did decide, I'm gonna take control now because I've got rogue people using team edition, he has to prove he controls the DNS. So that's how you do it. You create a CNAME of like some gibberish 20 character thing pointing to Google. They then check it and go, okay, yeah, in fact, this guy's the one that controls it. Yeah, do you have another follow-up?
No.
Okay, thought you did.
I mean, Stan, if you told Stan to hold off till the end because of his situation. I'm waiting for that answer.
Okay, go ahead.
Wow, no, I'm just saying, it's so much thinking, I don't mind the book.
But, woo! The
kid made probably about 30 sales today.
Your brother Casey could have sold more.
Just, you know, I'm having trouble seeing what I can do with this. Now, can you, maybe quickly, I've got a nonprofit and astronomy club. We've got about 50 members.
Uh-huh.
We have a web page. We have a calendar on there. We have events that we try to schedule, which I kind of maintain. Mm-hmm. But just quickly, how could I use this to help our club communicate?
Number one, you would register the domain name, point it at Google, set up the services you want. Now you could say to anybody, what's the name of the club? What's the domain name you have?
ASIMonline.org.
ASIM? ASIMonline.org. So you could say, hey, any member that wants an ASIMonline.org email address, it's yours. If you want to show that you're part of the group, then there you go. You could keep the official ASIMonline.org calendar of events on at Google, right, and then publish it. You can embed that into your website, or you could say, we're going to create an asimonline.org wiki where members can put, you know, it's just like any old wiki, members can log in, and that's where they have the accounts, right, and they can log in. Only members can edit the wiki, and this is a wiki for our members to use to share information about astronomy events, sightings, whatever. You could even embed the Google Calendar, I believe. You can embed it into the wiki. You can publish the wiki so everybody in the world can see the content on the wiki, but only members can edit it. So you could do that. That is using the calendar, the Gmail, the Google Sites.
We can let individual members update the calendar.
You could, what you would do is, there are ways to do that, yes.
Can you overlay an editable calendar over a non-editable version?
Sure.
That certain things are non-editable.
You don't have granular control over individual events. In other words, when you said calendar.
Yeah.
That's not events. I think you meant events. In other words, I'm subscribed to Jans's calendar, but it's read-only to me. I can't edit his calendar. But I can overlay it on top of my calendar.
And so, therefore, the events...
His events... Right.
...of those calendars display on yours.
Display on mine,
and
I can toggle it on and off, but they're not editable.
Okay.
Now, what I can do is I can create an event on my calendar and then invite however many guests I want. And when he gets it, he says yes, it now appears on his calendar as well. Which is a nice, I talk in the book, it's a nice replacement for Evite. I mean, you guys probably all got an Evite invitation. They're a pain in the ass. Well, if you're sending out an invitation to a party, all you got to do is create the party on your Google Calendar and click share, and then put everybody's email address in you want to send it to and hit save, and Google will automatically email every single person. If they've already got Google Calendar, they just click a yes, I will attend. You can see who's attending and who's not attending. When you go to the view, which is their way your group could use it. So
that's great. If I direct things to Google.
Yeah.
Well, your Google does not host regular old websites, right?
Stay there, and these other things will.
Yeah, because in the DNS, www.grandman.com, I could point to my Google Wiki, but I run a web hosting business with our own content management system. So again, it all comes down to DNS. I have www.grandman.com pointing to my server out in California that I control, but mail and calendar and docs and wiki are all pointing to Google, right? So, you know, ask Lee about DNS. I know he knows DNS backwards and forwards. I know some of the other guys do. I just know you do. You can pick and choose what you want to point where. So you could point your calendar to Google and the wiki at Google, but leave the www website wherever it is now. You know, now mail is, it's here or here. You can't split up mail effectively. Does that make sense?
Sorry.
There's lots of stuff. I mean, you can do, it's kind of up to you, whatever you want to use and utilize. And the cool thing is they're adding more stuff all the time.
We can talk about offline, Jim.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
If I'm in Firefox and I have two Gmail accounts, it's kind of a pain.
Oh, God, that is such a pain.
Is there a...
Yes, there is an extension for Firefox called Gmail Manager, and in the bottom right corner, you set it up, and you click on it, and it lists all of your accounts, and you can click and jump to that one. The problem is you can kind of have multiple tabs with different accounts, and it'll work for a couple of days, and then it won't. And you'll just have to close Firefox, open it back up, and then it'll work for a couple more days. I actually talk about that in the book at length, too. What I end up doing is I just have separate browsers. Or I actually, in the book, I was really proud of myself.
But you can have two different ones open.
You can have Firefox open pointing to separate profiles at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah. Ah. I go into the book about that. There's lots of little extra really super nerdy stuff in there like that where I figured out how to do it and read about it and go into detail about it in the book. Yes, you create an alias or shortcut or link, soft link, to Firefox telling it to open a certain profile. And you can have three different Firefoxes open, each with a separate profile open, which means, there you go, that solves the problem too. There's several other ways. I go through a bunch of them in there, but those are two that pop off the top of my head.
That's a separate instance of Firefox.
I mean, if you have multiple tabs open, every tab's more resources, too, so, you know, that'll do it. Also, have you guys ever heard of single site-specific browsers? Like, you ever heard of Prism for Mozilla, Mozilla Prism? No? It's a project where it's Firefox, but it's got its own individual profile directory, and you can create as many of them as you want. And so you could have, and it looks like its own application. It looks like its own program. So you would literally have a program on your desktop or in your applications menu that said GaryMeyer.com email or whatever the hell he wanted to, home email, and you clicked it and it would open in what looks like a program, not a browser. It's a stripped down Firefox. And then you could go to the next one that says work email, and it would open also in a stripped down Firefox, but they're completely separate. Look up Mozilla Prism, PRISM, and it's fun. It's way cool, way fun to play with. On Macs, Don, it's called Fluid. Fluid uses the WebKit browser rendering engine instead of Firefox, but Prism will also run on Macs. I have found on Macs that Fluid runs better than Prism. But that's another solution. That's really cool. Somebody else have their hand up? Yes, sir.
Is there any integration between calendar and docs?
I can't think of any.
Extract information out of calendar or docs?
There is between Gmail and calendar. If I send you an email saying, let's meet tomorrow at noon for lunch, and you're reading it in the web interface, on the right column, it'll say, add to calendar? Because it parses it, and if you click it, it'll open in the calendar and actually parse it and put lunch with Scott Graneman at noon tomorrow.
But you can't export the calendar stuff?
Of course. You can sync it or export it or whatever. It'll also detect addresses and send you to Google Maps. So if I emailed you, let's meet tomorrow at noon for lunch at this address with this zip, you'll have two things on the left, on the right column. One to add it to the calendar, and one that'll actually take you to Google Maps where you can map it and do all that stuff.
I'm thinking about situations where organizations have multiple people that do, say, time billing. So you have, everybody needs to know where they are, so you subscribe to their calendars, but somebody has to extract their information into a billing system.
Right. And in that case, you would probably want to start with the Google Forms and somehow use the forms so it goes into a spreadsheet that can be manipulated. Or, I barely touch on this in the book because then the book would have been 200 more pages. There's something called Google App Engine, which is Google's, where you can write your own programs in Python and host them on Google's cloud, and that they're pretty much the sky's the limit. So somebody could write a custom app in Python that lives at Google's cloud with a custom domain name, and they could enter do whatever they want with that. I barely touch on that in the book because there are actually books on that subject right now. So to wrap up the problem. Well, go ahead, Don.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I have an organization that has around 50 or 100 people in it. I don't have a calendar, basically. And one of the organizers sends out birthday announcements for me. And I was thinking it'd be neat to put all this long list of birthdays into the calendar. Is there a way to have a text file with name, birthday, and?
No, you'd have to put that into a calendar program. Well, okay, no, here's what you do. You'd write a script that would parse that text file and put it into iCal format. That would actually be really easy.
Put it into iCal.
Yeah, just put it into iCal format, then import that. That'd be easy. In fact, I bet somebody's already done that, you know. That would work. Okay, so last thing. Here's the problem. Way before Google Apps came out, let me back up. Gmail's been around a lot longer than Google Apps, right? Google Reader, which is an RSS, the best RSS reader I know of, is not part of Google Apps. Okay? There's lots of Google services that aren't part of Google Apps. For instance, you can create a YouTube account to upload YouTube videos and stuff. That's not part of Google Apps. I'm trying to think of other Google services that are not part of Google Apps. Well, here's the deal. What's that?
Grand Central,
which is their telephone integration system, right, is not part of Google Apps, although it should be. Well, here's the deal. When you create a Google account, okay, Google accounts want you to enter a unique email address. Well, guess what? I have a Google Apps account that's scottagranaman.com. I can then go create a Google account that is separate from the Google Apps account, and my login name is scottagranaman.com. That gets very confusing.
Unless yes. You forward your Gmail account to your Google Apps account.
No, because what happens is, trust me, you do not want to create an email account at the non-Google Apps account. I did that, and it... You know, dogs and cats slept together. The world started ending. It was very ugly. You do not want to do it. But here's the problem. And I go through this in voluminous detail in the book. Google Reader. I created a scottagranaman.com Google account because on my iPhone, to be honest, I got sick of having a separate login for Google Reader and a separate Google Apps login for other stuff. So I was like, I just want to use scottagranaman.com at everything. Here's the problem. Google Reader allows you to send emails to people of interesting items you read. So you click send to email, right? Well, the problem was I had no address book because I didn't have an email account at the non-Google Apps email. So I got tired of typing people's the same email. I wanted to email Robin something five times a day. I got tired of typing her email address in five times a day. So I was like, where is the address book? So there's all these little complications like that. I later found out, I found the secret URL that lets you get to an address book without having to have an email account. And I think it's in there. If it's not in there, or if you remind me, I'll give you the URL. But the problem is, you can have a Google Apps account and a non-Google Apps Google account with the same email address. But you got to be real careful about what services you enable on each one so they don't collide. Because all of a sudden you'll have a Google Apps account with a calendar and a non-Google Apps account with the same username with a calendar. And like I said, things start getting really ugly and really confusing. So be very careful on that. My advice would be...
I'm already confused.
I know.
Yeah.
It's really confusing, but the problem is
graphic to show us.
If you limit yourself to creating an account in Google Apps with an email address, and you never use other Google services, or if you do use non-Google Apps services, but you're willing to create an entirely separate account with a completely different email address, you'll never run into this problem. The problem you'll run into is if you have a Google Apps account and you create a Google account and they have the same email address.
But they don't.
But they do.
But the Gmail account is username only.
If that's a Gmail account, if you created this is part of because Google's grown organically.
Gmail, Google.
You can create a Gmail. If you create a Gmail account, you automatically then have a Google account with the Gmail address. But you can create a Google account with your own email address, which then gives you a Gmail address, Gmail account.
So you create a Google Apps account and then create the Gmail, a new Gmail account in it.
In what was the last two words?
In it.
No. When do you create a Google Apps account? You get Gmail as part of that account,
okay.
Unless for some
that's
weird reason you don't enable it. I'm saying you then go to regular old Google, mm-hmm. not Google Apps, but regular old Google, and create a Google account with the same email address. It will let you do that.
Why would you want a Google account?
Because there are lots of services Google has that aren't related to Google Apps.
Mainly on your web startup page, you know, that kind of thing.
Like Google Reader. Google Reader is not part of Google Apps.
The RSS stuff. Okay.
Right? Or YouTube, or Grand Central, or the 80 other things you can do with Google that aren't part of Google Apps. They're just separate. So, it's. I'm sorry to be, I know it's very confusing.
Picasa's
another one. I'm just trying to tell you, you want to try as much as possible to think about the separate accounts. Because Google, because it has grown organically, over time, they've allowed this confusion to happen, and it will produce a big fat mess if you are not really, really careful. Yes?
I think that I went to the calendar, uh-huh. created an account named stanr@slew.org.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think I ever created a Gmail account.
You have a Gmail account. You could have one. You haven't activated it. Don't activate.
But if you did, what would it be?
If he does, it will be something at Gmail, and it'll force you to use a different username, and I'm now remembering what the problem is. If you do that, here's what will happen. You'll go to the Gmail login page, you will log in as stanr@slew.org, and you know what will happen immediately? It'll switch you over to this other username it forced you to do. Which you don't want to do. So what happened was, when I created that second Gmail account, scottagranaman.com, it said, hey, there's already a scottagranaman.com email account in our system. You need to pick a different username. So I said, okay, our Scott Granaman, whatever. After that, every time I logged into scottagranaman.com to a non-Google Apps account, it switched it to our Scott Granaman. So I would send emails to Robin, and Robin's like, why am I getting emails from rscottgranaman@gmail.com? And I was like, no, I wanted it to come from scottagranaman.com. And it took, when I disabled Gmail and the non-Google Apps account, it took 5 days for it to stop doing it. It's complicated. And Gary's giving me the Apollo Theater clown coming out with the hook, pulling me off it. Sorry about the confusion at the end. As I said, it's in the book. Hope this has been helpful to you guys. If you guys got questions, email me. Let me know. I'll be glad to help you in whatever way I can. But thanks a lot. Look forward to seeing you all again.
Scott, you're going to be at...
Yeah!
Scott, that one, that one, the Aussies.
That one. That one.
Yeah. Okay.
By the way, there's always a story, but you can tell the people who are professional lecturers and teach at universities or something like that. We gave Scott 90 minutes. 88 minutes after he started talking, he goes, are there any questions?
Yes. 80 minutes and 20 seconds.